It's said to be a landmark Supreme Court case limiting free speech rights of our students when it comes to drugs. And it happened in Alaska. The Bong Hits for Jesus case is the subject of a book. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Joe Frederick's notorious banner in Juneau was pretty much meaningless, he said, but that's not how the court saw it. Our phone number, 1-800-478-825-5478-TALK, Anchorage number 5508422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to probe the world of the Supreme Court and its decisions today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century, member FDIC, equal housing lender. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, James C. Foster is a professor of political science at Oregon State University and author of Bong Hits for Jesus, A Perfect Constitutional Storm in Alaska's Capital. And he joins us by telephone from his office at the Cascades campus. Professor
Hey,
Foster,
Steve.
How? Hi, can I call you Jim or James or what would you like?
Jim Professor? Is fine.
Okay,
Jim is fine.
Great. This is a fascinating book, and it's published by the University of Alaska Press, and it has a picture of the banner right on the cover of it. And
right.
What I hadn't really entirely realized is, in all the fuss about this, Joe was trying to get this banner in the background as the Olympic torch goes down the street of Juneau. And
right.
Everybody's fussing about it, and he just wanted that to be in the TV shot, but it never made it into the TV shot. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah, somehow in the midst of all that, he didn't get on TV, and according to Deborah Morse, his principal standing across the street, she was so taken by the incident unfolding in front of her across Glacier Avenue that she missed the Olympic torch relay as it went by. So it was kind of an ironic situation.
Well, it was. Now, I want to know why you used the term. You're a political scientist. You're not a law scholar per se, but you do kind of specialize in the courts.
Right. My degree is in political science, PhD, but a subfield of political science is what's called sometimes judicial politics or law and courts or public law. It basically focuses on constitutional law and the Supreme Court.
Yeah. And it is, I mean, your portrayal from a political science view of the Supreme Court and its evolution and everything was just very illuminating to me. I really, really enjoyed it. But I want to ask you this question about your title. Why
yes.
exactly was this case a perfect constitutional storm?
Well, as I started investigating the whole situation and undertaking the 27 or so interviews that my partner and I did with regard to the book, it became clear that this controversy that started with a remote incident in a fairly remote place in Alaska basically sent Juneau off the rails. And what I mean by that is that people started drawing lines in the sand and choosing up sides. And ironically, rather than talking about the way in which the constitutional rights, First Amendment rights, were implicated in this, basically, it became a source of great anger and disagreement and divided the community. That's why I characterized it as a perfect constitutional storm, a storm that resulted in almost 7 years of litigation, three different courts, five different court hearings, and a Supreme Court decision that was deeply divided. So it quickly blew up into this situation that resulted in a lot of divisiveness in the community.
I think you're disagreeing with the opening statement, which was it is said to be a landmark Supreme Court case limiting the free speech rights of our students when it comes to drugs. And your analysis, actually, of the decision makes it quite a bit less than that because of the way that the justices divided. Maybe you could go into that a little bit. And, you know, because it seems like they could have been even more narrow. They could have just, you know, for instance, said, we don't think it's right that this guy gets damages from this principal just trying to do her job.
Right.
They could have just done that.
They could have, but they didn't. The typical newspaper account, journalistic account of the June 2007 decision is 5-4 in favor of Deborah Morse creating a drug speech exception to students' First Amendment rights. That's kind of like the standard analysis of Morris versus Frederick. And yet, if you look at the decision, it is much more, as the word I use, Steve, it's messy. The decision is much more messy than that kind of clean-cut 5-4 decision, because, in fact, there are five different opinions, and ironically, the only plurality opinion in the whole mess is the dissent of Souter, Stevens, and Ginsburg, in which they argue that Joe Frederick's rights were violated. And basically what the court holds by barely five votes is that because the principal saw the banner reasonably as drug speech, the word bong hits being prominently featured, because Deborah Moore saw it as drug speech, and because the school district has a policy against drug speech, it was her responsibility to cross Glacier Avenue and tell him to take it down. And the court said that she had the authority to do that. But the law in general, and constitutional law decisions in particular, are notoriously malleable. They're notoriously permeable. And you can take the language, which itself is ambiguous, and the voting alignments, and use them in subsequent decisions to support different positions. And as a matter of fact, one could argue, and some people do argue, that with this drug speech exception, the Supreme Court basically is closing the door on students' speech rights. But it's a much more complicated situation than that. I mean, you want me to go into even more detail about the messy decision itself?
Yeah, I think so. For one thing, it is nonsensical. The content of the message is nonsensical, but it does inarguably pertain to drugs. And it would seem that for some justices, that pressed a hot button that, and we know in this country, we're very willing to give up our civil liberties in the event of war. I mean, it's just happened over and over and over again. You got a war, it's a cold war, any kind of war, and you start giving up rights. I mean, we just do that. And we've always this war on drugs, and certain justices right. really related to that. Oh, if it's got to do with drugs, it's disruptive, and it's against the peace and dignity of the schools.
Well, I basically argue with my students that when it comes to the war on drugs, the court is all too willing and eager to trade off First Amendment rights, but free speech rights, students' rights, and certainly Fourth Amendment rights. I basically argue to my students that when it comes to any situation involving automobiles and drugs, you have no expectation of privacy, which is the threshold question when it comes to having First Amendment, Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizures. But basically what you have in Morris versus Frederick, Steve, is a two-vote opinion by John Roberts and Antonin Scalia, basically saying, as I put it a while ago, that because Deborah Morse reasonably interpreted the banner as drug speech, she had the authority to tell Joe Frederick to take it down, and that students' free speech rights stop when it comes to drug speech. That commanded two votes. Then you had Sam Alito and Anthony Kennedy arguing, well, we agree with this, but we are concerned that the court might be giving too much discretion to school administrators to interpret speech broadly in ways that impacts students' First Amendment rights. And this decision in Morris v. Frederick is as far as we're going to go without infringing upon the First Amendment. Then you have Clarence Thomas, who basically said, look, Tinker versus Des Moines, that landmark decision in 1968 that involved black armbands that kids wore to school during the Vietnam War, that was wrongly decided in 1968. Our whole students' rights jurisprudence is wrongheaded because students should be seen and not heard. They have no First Amendment rights as long as they cross the schoolhouse threshold. So there's the majority. But as I say, it's messy because it's all over the place, right? You really only have two votes to create that drug speech exception. Then you have Stephen Breyer. I call him Stephen sitting on the fence Breyer, and he basically articulates the position you were articulating at the top. Look, let's not even touch the constitutional issue. Let's not go there because we're going to divide on it. Let's simply hold that Joe Frederick cannot ask damages from Deborah Morse and leave it at that. And then you have the three dissenters who say that we don't know what bong hits for Jesus means, but it certainly isn't drug speech. It's probably nonsensical sophomoric speech. And the Constitution protects sophomoric nonsensical speech. So the opinion was all over the place.
Wow.
Now, if you're a school administrator sitting in your office and you're trying to figure out what you would do in a similar situation, or if a situation blew up where you had to make a snap decision weighing a student's rights to express themselves versus your authority as principal, I don't think you'd get a hell of a lot of instruction from Morris v. Frederick. It's confusing.
Well, the school board lobby filed amicus on this, and they certainly were worried about the erosion of the authority of the people that run the schools, as you would think they would be.
Oh, yeah. Both DARE, right, this drug abuse resistance pro education, right, drug abuse resistance education, DARE and the National Association of School Boards filed amicus briefs with the principal. Yeah, and they were very scared that the court would side with Joe Frederick and in the process chill administrators' discretion. But you know, frankly, what the National Association of School Boards and a whole lot of administrators, including Carol Como in Anchorage, were really upset about was Joe Frederick not only sued for a declaration of the constitutional issue, but he also sued for damages. And that's another aspect to this whole business about why it's a perfect constitutional storm, Steve. When the issue blew up, lines got drawn in the sand, people started getting angry, and they started hurling accusations at each other, and it got a little vindictive. And what I think is a tactical mistake on Doug Mertz and Joe Frederick's part was that they sued for damages. And the clearest evidence of that is at oral argument after Ken Starr had his 20 minutes and reserve 10 behind the lectern, Doug Mertz gets up and says, may it please the court, this case is not about drug speech, it's about student rights. And John Roberts interrupts him and says, I thought it was about money. Your client wants money from Deborah Morse. So that was one indication of the level of vituperation that was going on in this case.
Well, yeah. And but, you know, I'm just, you know, you go back to the original situation and you can see why Doug was pushing it the way he was. And that was because he genuinely feels that his client was damaged. In other words, Frederick, you know, sort of in a lot of ways got what he wanted because, you know, he wanted to be, I think, provocative because that's kind of the kind of rebel kid that he is or was.
Yep.
this is perfect from his point of view, and it caused a lot of trouble. Even more perfect.
Yeah,
I mean, he got suspended. He seriously disciplined. He had his car searched and so forth.
Yeah, and you see, that's another aspect of the perfect constitutional storm is that, in a way, the incident on Glacier Avenue became a lightning rod, which resulted in triggering a whole lot of pre-existing, if I could put it that way, pre-existing grudges, angers, and misunderstandings. I mean, Joe Frederick and Deborah Morse had a long history with each other from the time he arrived as a junior a year before this whole incident blew up. And when the litigating started, I still maintain that it was from a principled point of view, if you're interested in vindicating your constitutional rights, it is something of a distraction to tag on punitive damages to that case. But I can understand why Doug wanted to sue for damages, because as far as he was concerned, the incident on Glacier Avenue with the banner was only the tip of the iceberg, no pun intended, right? The other 90% was the history of harassment from his point of view and from Joe's point of view that Joe had suffered ever since he arrived in Juneau.
Well, next week we're going to have Anthony Romero, the head of the ACLU, on the program. And I would expect that the ACLU was concerned by this ruling of the court. And one of the things Anthony's going to talk about is how they're trying to find other ways to ensure civil liberties besides going to the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, and there is a very prominent and influential avenue open to them, one that was supported and argued for by Justice Brennan beginning in the mid-70s. And then as we got deeper into the Berger and early Rehnquist court, Justice Brennan argued that if you are interested in protecting civil rights and civil liberties, do not come to the Supreme Court because given the current composition, you're likely to lose. Litigate at the state level using state constitutions. So the ACLU could pursue that route of not taking it all the way to the Supremes, but if you're going to take it to the Supremes, take it to the court of last resort in the state where the litigation arises.
Yeah. And another thing that I guess clearing the air about the courts and their structures that we ought to bring in at this point is just that the Ninth Circuit is not well regarded by critics of the activist judiciary. In other words, our regional court for like the West Coast, the Northwest, your state, my state, and Hawaii and California.
And Montana and Arizona. Yeah, right.
is generally thought to be too liberal by many. Or certainly the most liberal of the circuit courts of appeal,
right? And yet there's the scholarly literature that I looked at and that gets reviewed in the book indicates that argument about the Supreme, that the Ninth Circuit being out of step with the Supreme Court and too liberal, is something of a red herring. It all depends on your political perspective, and the Ninth Circuit may have been staying somewhat in the same place over the past 15, 20 years, but what has moved to the right is the Supreme Court. So one could stand the argument on its head and say it's the Supreme Court under Rehnquist and now Roberts that is out of step rather than the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. But that argument, I mean, one of the people I talked to when we were exploring the question of why the Supreme Court decided to grant cert, this obscure case out of Juneau, his answer was, well, it was the Ninth Circuit, and they always love tweaking the Ninth Circuit, right, whenever they can get a chance. Right?
Well, yeah, but I mean, on this issue of certiorari,
yes,
hardly any cases that are appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court actually get accepted, and yet they did accept this one. And one thing you point out very nicely, I think, in your book, a whole chapter of amicus briefs, and the friends and the various interest groups who are filing these things that I have always thought of, well, does anybody even read them? You know, it's sort of like a Me Too-ism, right? You know, you got your parties in the case, and then you have all these extra ones that come in, and they just want to throw something extra onto it. Well, watch out for me. Watch out for my interest. But you point out that when you look at the current structure of the Supreme Court and the clerks and so forth, that amicus briefs actually, especially when it comes to deciding whether or not to take up a case, may be very, very influential.
Yes. Yeah. And one of the interesting things about the 12 amicus briefs that were filed in this case is that five of them were from fairly conservative evangelical religious groups like the Liberty Council from Liberty University, Jerry Falwell's university. And one might think, now, how do you put Liberty University with Joe Frederick holding up a banner of bong hits for Jesus? And there was a lot of chatter on the web and op-ed comments about so-called odd bedfellows. I argued that they were not such odd bedfellows because if you read those amicus briefs, and you know, sidebar to your question, who reads these briefs are other attorneys and these groups who are concerned and track issues like student speech and religious speech and administrative discretion. They read those amicus briefs very carefully, as do the clerks of the Supreme Court justices who figure centrally in the whole decision-making process. But that's a sidebar. My point is that the way you put the Liberty Council with Joe Frederick is that these conservative religious groups were seriously concerned that if the court took the case and then sided with Deborah Morse in a way that painted administrative discretion in broad brushstrokes and gave school principals wide discretion to decide what was acceptable speech and what wasn't, that religious speech might get swept up in that dragnet. And they didn't want the court to go that broadly. And in fact, they succeeded because the court didn't go that broadly, as I said in analyzing the opinion. You really only have two votes, Roberts and Scalia, for administrative discretion when it comes to drug speech, A third vote, Clarence Thomas, who would give administrators essentially carte blanche, and then that's it. I mean, the other members of the court were very reluctant and wanted to build a firewall between this particular case and principals seeing speech they just particularly didn't like and calling it to account.
You know, it's actually fascinating, and there's a bit of a precedent there too for religious groups to pile on this one, because one of the important Supreme Court cases with regards to student speech rights has to do with Jehovah's Witnesses and their right not to say under God or something like that.
Yeah, West Virginia School District versus Barnett. That is perhaps the landmark decision, the early seminal decision with regard to students' rights, and it held that students with religious convictions did not have to stand and recite the Pledge of Allegiance, and they had a First Amendment right essentially not to engage in that particular exercise. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because while you've got these five religious groups urging the court not to hand down a broad decision endorsing administrative discretion, you have another group like the Lambda Legal Defense Fund basically urging the court to distinguish between Joe Frederick's drug speech. First of all, they say, you know, uphold Joe Frederick's First Amendment right to hold this banner up. But if you're going to side with Principal Morse, please side with her in a way that distinguishes between religious speech, which is protected, and hate speech directed toward gays and lesbians, which ought to be subject to administrative sanction.
Wow. And I think, you know, it also comes that when it came to deciding whether to appeal, that the school board, regardless of Deborah Morse, was persuaded and egged on by other school boards because just authority was left in doubt.
That's right. That's
you know,
right.
If the Ninth Circuit ruling had prevailed, and
yeah.
You know, basically you had Judge Sedgwick here in Anchorage, who said, come on, Joe, you don't have a case.
Right.
They appealed that to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit essentially said she was wrong to have disciplined him for this. But for people in school districts, that set off alarm bells all across the country.
Right. And as I say, when my partner and I were doing our interviews, it became very clear in talking to, say, Sally Smith, who was mayor of Juneau at the time, and Carol Como in Anchorage, that what really upset school officials and school board members was the damages aspect of the suit. They certainly thought that Joe Frederick was out of line and had no constitutional right to hold this banner up. But they were less concerned about that. As a matter of fact, some of them were somewhat critical of Deborah Morse's exercise of authority and wish she could have figured out a way to make this less of a confrontation and more of a conversation. But what really upset the school officials and school board members was the damages and how it would have a chilling effect. Ironically, you know, using the phrase chilling effect is usually used with regard to First Amendment rights court decisions that have a negative effect on them. But the school board officials were concerned that a damage award against Deborah Morse would have a chilling effect on administrators. I think the way Carol Como put it was, imagine you were an administrator and you'd seen one of your colleagues have incur a damage award because of a decision she make. Wouldn't that make you very intimidated the next time you had to make that sort of decision?
Well,
which
yeah.
Some people might argue is a good idea. You know,
yeah.
Well, high school principals can be pretty authoritarian on occasion.
Yeah, we're talking with James C. Foster, professor of political science at Oregon State University, author of Bong Hits for Jesus, A Perfect Constitutional Storm in Alaska's Capital. Now, inarguably, there's a drug problem in a lot of schools. And
right.
Arguably, this would say, well, we've got a war on drugs. We really don't want to. The public display of drug advocacy is not something that that should go undealt with,
right.
Let's say. But, you know, you put it, you suggest at the end of your book that that's not the best way to be dealing with a drug problem in the schools, that if everybody talks, maybe we'll get further along.
Right. And I use the example of Tigard, Oregon, a suburb of Portland that in the mid-'80s had a brand new principal. And one of the first things the principal did was to announce a dress code. And among the things banned by the dress code were any shirts advertising any sort of alcoholic beverages. So not surprisingly, shortly after the dress code was announced, a number of seniors wore beer T-shirts to school, testing the new dress code. Several of them were sent home. There was talk of suspending one of the ringleaders of the shirt in. tempers started rising. It was looking like it's not deja vu because it preceded the Juneau event, but it looked like a precursor to the Juneau event. Phone calls were being made from parents to the ACLU. And finally, an organization by the name of the Classroom Law Project here in Portland, in cooperation with a couple of high school civics teachers at Tigard High School, went to the principal and said, let's try and channel the negative energy that's developing here around this dress code policy into getting the students to create a mock Supreme Court. So what they did is they had students choose up sides on both, is both in support of the dress code and the penalties associated with it, and arguing against the dress code in terms of student rights. They had to do research. They cooperated with local attorneys who had volunteered. A mock Supreme Court was put together with law professors and faculty and some local attorneys, and the kids presented the cases. And it diffused, and not only diffused the frustration and anger that was going on, it channeled the students' energy into converting into, you know, the cliche, of course, Steve, is a teachable moment. What that means is that it created the opportunity for students to talk about, to debate, and make choices about these very difficult issues. And that's very, very different, 180 away from the way in which the situation unfolded in Juneau.
I think we'll go to a break and try and get a little bit better line connection. We're getting a little pixelation there with our phone connection with you, Jim. So I think we'll take a break at this point and be back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
What rights do our students have? What rights has the Supreme Court taken away from our students? What rights actually might promote learning as opposed to get in the way of learning? Some pretty heavy questions raised by the issue of the Bong Hits for Jesus case. Strange wording, though it may have. Do we have a connection again with Jim?
I'm here.
Okay, Jim Foster, yeah, good to hear from you. Professor of Political Science, Oregon State University. And I think that we're seeing an erosion in recent Supreme Court decisions, rather substantial erosion of students' rights, not just the speech, but for their personal privacy, for, you know, being searched and stuff like that, random drug tests and so forth. I mean, it would seem that I'm wondering how much lower it could even go.
Well, that is a subject of heated controversy among court watchers. Both from the journalist side and the more academic side, and there are people who would subscribe to the title of one of these articles reviewing the Supreme Court's work that students now shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. And that particular way of phrasing it refers back to the landmark decision Tinker versus Des Moines School District in 1968 that arose out of the Vietnam War. A family in Des Moines by the name of Tinker, Mary Beth Tinker, and her son and her brother John wore black armbands to school commemorating the assassination of Robert Kennedy. They were informed that it violated school policy. Unless they removed the armbands, they'd be suspended. They were suspended. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in a 7-2 decision written by Abe Fortas, the court upheld the students' rights under the First Amendment to wear the armbands, and the language that Justice Fortas used in his opinion was that it is incontrovertible that teachers and students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. That was in 1968. Two subsequent First Amendment cases and two Fourth Amendment cases that I think you're referring to have significantly eroded the Tinker rule. And basically, what we have is a situation that where, in particular, where drugs are involved, Steve, students' constitutional rights are essentially traded off against school authority to maintain a safe and conducive educational environment.
So maybe it's almost denial. Okay. Oh, we'll just not mention the problem and it'll go away.
Well, yeah, except that, you know, high school students being high school students, they're going to push the envelope as the Tigard situation involves. But even if they're not pushing the envelope, the two Fourth Amendment cases having to do with unreasonable searches and seizures, one aspect that's troubling about those cases is that these were basically model students. The one case is out of Vernonia, Oregon, up in Columbia County, of Vernonia versus Acton, and James Acton was a kid who just wanted to go out for football, and he was informed if he wanted to play football, he had to submit to a urine test. He and his parents objected. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court basically held that students involved in sports had no expectations of privacy, and because of the unique educational environment of schools, the school could enforce random suspicionless drug tests. Then a few years later, in a case out of Oklahoma, the court extended that principle to any student who wanted to go out for any school activity. The young woman who was involved, her name was Earls, essentially was an honor student who wanted to be involved in the choral society. Now, it sort of stretches one's imagination that being involved in a choral group, a singing group, is somehow connected to or legitimizes random suspicionless drug tests. But that's
you just don't understand. I'm in the profession. And let me tell you, we get hooked on the nose spray because it makes our voices sound better.
An Afrin addict, huh?
Yeah, I am telling you. I won't even get into the lip gloss situation. Well,
I've always thought that whole Carmex business was sort of an urban legend, but apparently it can be addictive.
Let's go to Caroline, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Jim Foster, Caroline.
Well, good morning. There are so many issues to this that it boggles the mind that they could sort out one or the other. The teacher, I would think that all school, once you cross the line, that you do not have expectations of privacy. The same thing attaches to anyone that works for the government. They can't hide cocaine in their chair cushion. They can't make use of the computers in a way that they're not supposed to. I mean, that has been established, I think, some time ago. But how the teacher could have rights beyond the property boundary to try and exert her will past that seems to be the same line that can be drawn. Some of our young people are used to the image of the child that tells the parents they can't go into the bedroom, and whether the parents pay the mortgage or not, and you have kids building bombs, a la the Columbine kids. So, you know, all of this is a big jumble as to the rights of young people, and the age of majority covers some of that. You're not allowed to drive until you're 16. You're not allowed to drink until you're 21, et cetera, et cetera. I think if there had been a Reed College graduate that was very liberal and the kid had been standing across the street with a very pro church message, for instance, and I can see why the churches got all in a dither because of that, then I don't know if you'd have had the same issue being brought up. The young man, of course, in trying to exert his rights through a civil suit, was in an uphill slog from what I am seeing. But nonetheless, he was damaged by this woman exerting her control over his actions off school property.
Caroline, I want to pick that one up here with Jim and see what he has to say, because that's the most oft-repeated phrase with regards to this case, off school property.
One quick thing on T-shirts.
Yeah.
A recent study showed that teens who wear shirts advocating anything, i.e. Cigarettes, et cetera, that they're 19% more likely to use the product. So no wonder they like giving away the T-shirt.
All right.
Well, apropos of that, I mean, you raise a lot of important issues. And a couple of things. First of all, Steve is right. One of the most oft-stated defenses of Joe Frederick was that he was standing on a public sidewalk across the street from the high school and that he hadn't gone to school that day. Another way of putting that was he's truant. And that using that word leads me to another observation, that what was going on in this particular situation has to be understood in a larger context of adversarial relations between Joe Frederick, the student, and Deborah Morse, the principal. In other words, they had a history. By the time the torch relay came down Glacier Avenue on January 24, 2001, Deborah Morse and her assistant principal, Dale Staley, had been around the block with Joe Frederick a lot of times. And so when that banner went up, I'm pretty sure, listening to Deborah when she did our interview and in reading about the situation, I'm pretty sure that what went through her mind was, there he goes again. And there he, Joe, goes again, and there he goes in a very public context in a way that's going to be seriously embarrassing to the school and to me. And so that banner triggered a whole lot of history. Another point is that with regard to the sidewalk and across the street, when the school district got to the Supreme Court and they had hired Kenneth Starr to argue their case, Kenneth Starr successfully made two points. First of all, that this was not just benign speech. The term bong hits refers to a specific paraphernalia that's used in the smoking of marijuana. It was reasonable for Deborah Morse to interpret that as drug speech. And moreover, this was an event that the school district had been involved in planning. It had created curriculum. It had designed bus transport routes. It had created schedules for release time. The analogy that Ken Starr was successful in persuading the court to adopt is that this was an outdoor assembly, and as such, the authority of the principal extended to all of the students throughout the event, no matter where they were standing at the time. Now, people can debate that, and people do argue that, but that is the argument that succeeded before the Supreme Court.
Well, the Supreme Court is certainly not working under the rules of sanity from my perspective, but but again, it's a matter of boundaries, and our boundaries visually certainly exceed our boundaries in the personal sphere. So I disagree adamantly. The young man may be a thorn in her side, but if she is a good administrator, there are other ways to deal with that. And I do like the idea of the youth courts. They've been very successful. I've never understood why school uniforms are good for rich kids in private schools, and yet they're anathema to our public schools, but that's a separate issue. On the property, they have a lot of rights, they being the government, because the child is not required to attend school. So they go to make use of the school, what the government has to offer to them, and they have the responsibility, as do public employees, to adhere to the rules of the people that own the property.
Well, one of the criticisms that was articulated of Deborah Morse was that even if she had the authority to tell Joe Frederick to take the banner down and then suspend him according to a sort of rigid disciplinary grid that was used at Juno Douglas High School, even if all that's the case, she exercised that authority irresponsibly, and she could have been a little less punitive, more imaginative, and converted the situation into the opportunity to perhaps have an assembly at which students would debate the boundaries, as you put it, of student rights and the boundaries of a school administrator's discretion. But as it is, it turned into a disciplinary situation followed by a considerable amount of litigating and frustration and anger on the part of a lot of Juno residents.
Well, thank you for the book, and I'm looking forward to reading it. Picking your fights is something adults like me sometimes have difficulty still mastering. So this woman, I think, was clearly in the wrong, whether or not she liked what the young man was saying or approved it or didn't approve it. Her rights, as far as I'm concerned, and the municipality's rights, ended at the edge of that property.
Yeah, picking your fights, that's a very good way of putting it.
All right, Caroline, thanks
a lot.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for your call.
Telephone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. And we're talking with Jim Foster, who has written the book Bong Hits for Jesus, A Perfect Constitutional Storm in Alaska's Capital. It kind of really analyzes not just the Supreme Court and the decision and all that, but the people and what might have been and wasn't. But it seems often, you know, it's just like if you're having a fight, you're having some kind of domestic dispute and somebody calls the cops. It's like not only is there not much class in that, but it often just doesn't help, you know. And if somebody goes to the point of going to court on something, very often that doesn't help.
No, as a matter of fact, it can create a worse situation. I think that's one of the lessons of this whole almost 7 years of litigating. There is a classic student of judicial politics and courts by the name of Jerome Frank. He's often mentioned as one of the two most brilliant American jurists who was never appointed to the Supreme Court, the other one being Learned Hand. And Frank wrote a book called Courts on Trial, in which he talks about the fight theory of justice and traces litigating all the way back to medieval times when there were tests and ordeals to determine the truth or falsity of claims and to resolve disputes. And his basic argument is that lawsuits are the contemporary equivalent of fights. Well, those fights can have side effects which are not necessarily desirable. I mean, rather than trying to resolve the dispute, what you do is you choose up sides, hire attorneys, and duke it out in front of a judge or a panel of judges. And eventually what happened in Juno was that after years of litigating and hundreds of thousands of dollars spent in the process, the municipality and the citizens essentially kind of got tired and got exhausted by the whole process, and it ended up being a sort of war of attrition that, despite their Supreme Court victory, ended up with them settling with Joe Frederick, giving him a cash award, and organizing the very school assembly that he and Doug Meritz had suggested 6 years earlier. I mean, it was like two punch-drunk fighters locked in this embrace, both exhausted and finally just kind of falling toward their respective corners, calling it quits.
They're probably still that way.
Oh, hey, you know, as a matter of fact, I have a good friend in Juneau who's an attorney, and after the book came out and University of Alaska Press was interested in organizing readings and signings of the book, I broached the subject with Bill of going to Juno, and he said it was tongue-in-cheek, I hope. But he said, you know, I don't know if you want to come to Juno.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. You know, it's funny. You hear a professor of political science specializing in the courts, especially the Supreme Court, and you sound really like you want to work your way out of a job. That you know, you're arguing all over the place that, geez, if these people would just talk things over, maybe they could get somewhere. And you're also often criticizing a lack of, what do you call it? Is it judicial creativity, I think?
Judicial imagination is what I would call it.
Imagination, yes.
Yeah, well, I think that Americans, this is sort of a broad brushstroke generalization, but I'll make it anyhow. I'll crawl out on the limb. I've taught these subjects for 30 plus years now, and one of the conclusions I've arrived at, Steve, is that Americans are entirely too given to looking to courts to resolve our disputes, and in particular, the Supreme Court. We have this illusion that when the Supreme Court speaks, that's the end of the matter, when in fact it's not the end of the matter. It's just one more voice in an ongoing political controversy. Just kind of like the clear example of that is our ongoing acrimonious debate over abortion in this country. The Supremes are entirely too involved in trying to resolve these disputes when Americans could use some imagination and figure out ways to, in fact, give life to the First Amendment and exercise freedom of speech and civil speech and engage in the kind of tough conversations that might just possibly enlarge our understanding of each other in these issues.
Well, you know, you got your checks and balances that we all learned about in high school civics. And one of the things that we learned as we studied our political science is that the Supreme Court really isn't a non-political body, that it's going to reflect the politics of the people that are appointed to it. But and hence, as the appointments go on, there's just kind of a time lag to where, you know, earlier, like Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Bill Clinton, politics are reflected in our current judges. And of course, W. Bush. Are reflected on our current justices. So it's kind of a time lag, but it generally kind of echoes the politics of the time in which these people were appointed, although they do tend to change. They become sort of different people as they age on the bench, I think. But regardless, it seems that we're kind of in a situation now where we have a hugely conservative court. I'm wondering if the system might just be broken.
Well, the system of senatorial review and confirmation is broken because it's so deeply partisan, but that is symptomatic of the larger partisan deadlock that exists in the Senate of the United States. We've got this current debate over what we're going to do about raising the debt ceiling, and the Senate of the United States called back into a session after the 4th of July holiday is going to spend most of the week arguing over a filibuster. You know, it's sort of crazy. But to your larger point, yeah, the court. There was an American satirist in the early part of the 20th century by the name of Peter Dooley, and he coined the phrase that the court follows the election returns, but it doesn't directly follow the election returns. There is this sort of lag, and that there are very important watershed moments in the court's history where the court begins to parallel or reflect those election returns. Franklin Roosevelt remade the court from the 1940s until the end of his life with Supreme Court appointments. And ever since then, successive Republican presidents from Richard Nixon through Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush have essentially tried to unravel that New Deal coalition, and they have done so quite successfully, but not definitively. And what I mean by that is that the court, as you say, is much more conservative in 2011 than it was, say, in 1986 when Warren Berger left the court. But it is not definitively more conservative in the sense that certain bedrock constitutional principles have been trimmed, narrowed, and foreshortened, like Tinker versus Des Moines, okay, or in our subject, student rights. Tinker versus Des Moines has not been overturned. Tinker versus Des Moines has simply been narrowed and restricted and honed down. Now, what would be really significant is if Clarence Thomas' position, remember Clarence?
Yes.
It would really be significant if Clarence Thomas' position, namely that students have no First Amendment rights and Tinker versus Des Moines should be overturned, if that commanded a majority, that would be a profound and fairly definitive rejection of the late Warren Court's view of student rights.
I see, yeah.
That hasn't happened.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Hasn't happened, and we even saw Alito in this case really wanting to narrow this decision very, very closely.
Right, and draw a line in the sand.
Yeah.
And what you have is a country deeply divided over fundamental values and principles, and the court reflects that. Basically, what you have is a Kennedy court.
Okay.
John Roberts is chief, but Kennedy, the way Kennedy votes is the way the court goes because it's so narrowly divided. Had Barack Obama lost the 2008 presidential election and David Souter and John Paul Stevens had resigned from the relatively, I use that word on purpose, relatively more liberal wing of the court, and you would have had a Republican president appointing him, then we might have seen some definitive changes. But now you've got Sandra Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, basically one for one, one liberal out, one liberal back in, right? Which is why I say this sounds sort of a sidebar, but it's right on point with regard to the court and American politics. I tell my students, you know, presidents come and presidents go, but presidents appoint Supreme Court justices, and they hang on for a long time, and the trend now is to appoint bright, young, articulate, conservative justices who are going to stick around. So
right.
The 2012 presidential election is going to be real crucial with regard to the court.
Got to take a break here. Our guest is James Foster, author of Bong Hits for Jesus, A Perfect Constitutional Storm in Alaska's Capital, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
And we'll go to Unicleet and Joanne. Joanne, you're on Talk of Alaska with James Foster.
Yes, good morning. Very interesting article, topic. In Bethel, during the local option law debate a number of years ago, and then the vote that they had later on to make Bethel go dry, one of the arguments against allowing Bethel to go dry was that people's rights were being violated. And I would just like to hear some of the comments regarding this.
Well, that's an old argument in American politics that has kind of surfaced and disappeared over the last 230 years around the whole notion of temperance, right? Sobriety, and the way it plays out in a constitutional context is the question of to what extent, what are the limits of government authority in regulating private human behavior, namely the purchase and consumption of alcoholic beverages. And that's a very live wire argument, the focus of which, given American values, is that individuals should be at liberty to make choices with regard to alcoholic beverages without the encumbrance of government regulation to the largest extent possible. But then on the other side, there are lots of arguments about public health and public morality and domestic violence that line up on the side of government having a legitimate role to play with regard to regulating human behavior. You know, the argument also plays out with regard to motorcycle helmets, with regard to seat belts. It's an argument as old and as American as apple pie, this whole tension between government regulation and individual liberty.
Yeah, and I guess where it cuts often is local. At least that's what we're trying to do in Alaska, is create a viable local option where when it's overwhelmingly clear that just about everybody in the community is willing to give up their rights, they go ahead and do it, seems to be what's going on. Joanne, I want to thank you very much for that and move on to Duane. Joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Jim Foster.
Hello, thanks. I teach American history and civics, and I actually use this case in my classes. And
good.
It's really interesting. What I found over the years that's really intrigued me is with you have you know, teenage kids who you would think would be the most rebellious and want to fight for their rights, they're becoming more and more accepting of the loss of their freedom of expression. I'm finding that they are, especially when it comes to drugs or any of the hate speech and things like that, we discuss that they are, well, no, they can't do that. And I'm like, well, isn't it your freedom of expression? And I just thought that was really interesting. I've noticed over the years that teenagers who you would think would be fighting for their rights are actually willing to give them up.
You know, that's a very, very, very good point, I think. If you don't know what freedom is, maybe you don't treasure it.
Yeah, and you haven't had that taste of being able to articulate your views without being jeopardized or punished for them. If you haven't been in that situation, how do you explain this, Duane? Do you think your students have never been in a situation where they've had to make a choice between exercising their free speech and school authority?
Well, I don't think they feel they have the power is the thing, because, well, and you've seen the examples, and we look at them, too, ever since Tinker, basically, they have ruled in the favor of the school. And if you ask them, they say, no, we don't have any rights in the school. We don't have our freedom is ended, you know.
Whoa.
Wow, that's sort of depressing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it seriously is. I tried to instill them, but, you know, no, that isn't true. You have the court system.
Okay,
yeah.
I hate to. Okay, thanks a lot for that call, Duane. I'm going to ask you
thanks,
this,
Duane.
Jim. This one comes from Clay, who says, hey, I thought that banner was a joke. What, is humor protected speech? I'll let you handle that one for a little bit here, Jim.
Well, as a matter of fact, that photograph was taken by a person named Clay. I don't know if that's the same Clay, but the photograph on the cover was taken by Clay Good, who was a biology teacher.
It is Clay.
It is Clay Good, yeah. Hello, Clay. In any event, Clay saw the whole thing as a rabble-rousing, good fun, good sport, humorous event, and it would have let it slide. The interesting thing, the more I got into this case, the more I realized that the banner incident was simply the trigger, and what it triggered was a whole set of responses and fairly long-term history between Joe Frederick and Deborah Morse, and so what fueled the ultimate constitutional storm, Steve, was this whole set of relationships and interactions that came to a head when Joe Frederick held up that banner. And the banner itself, silly, sophomoric, humorous, but she didn't see it that way. She saw it through the lenses of Joe Frederick, troublemaker.
Thanks, Jim Foster.
Thank you, Steve.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, Anthony Romero of the ACLU. Thanks to Dave Waldron, Josh Edge, and I think Heather Arono.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.